I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about books and the people who write them. In a few days, we will celebrate the Indiana Authors Awards and the Indiana Author Fair, when the state takes note of the best in Indiana literature. We're going to have an advanced discussion today. My guests will be Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation and Michael Sheldon, this year's National Award winner in the Indiana Authors Awards competition. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the Indy Author Fair and the Indiana Authors Awards. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, my guests are a veteran now of No Limits, Laura Wills, who is with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. Laura, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, John.
And we have with us, and pleased to have with us, the 2014 National Author Award winner in the Indiana Authors Awards, biographer Michael Sheldon. Michael, congratulations and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, first, Laura, I'm going to start with you. Tell me a little bit and tell the audience a little bit about what the Authors Awards are and what the Author Fair is.
Sure. This is the sixth year for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award, and it was designed to celebrate Indiana authors and kind of promote the literary landscape across Indiana. We have so many talented Indiana authors who live in our state or are from our state, and so we just wanted a way to celebrate that. So part of the award program is the Indy Author Fair on Saturday, October 25th at Central Library. And it's a day full of free public programs for writers and book lovers of all ages.
And Michael, could you talk a little bit about what winning means to you? We're going to dive into the books themselves, but I think we probably ought to talk a little bit about what this occasion is and what the honor means.
Well, I've worked all over the world, but I regard myself as a Hoosier. I've lived here for about 40 years now of my life, and I love Indiana history and I love Indiana literature. So for me to be placed anywhere in the pantheon of Indiana writers is really nice. I appreciate it a lot. It's a great honor. I'm a huge fan of an author that lived here, Booth Tarkington. I love his work, and so, you know, I think promoting Indiana authors is a terrific thing to do.
And I am going to dive into the books now, because as I told you before we went on the air, I particularly admire one of your biographies, the Mark Twain one. Mark Twain, Man and White, I think, is the subtitle after the colon, which is this really, really moving exploration of his last years. But I've noticed you've written books also about Orwell, about Churchill. You say you're working now on a book on Melville. What spurs you? Where do you find the subjects that you want to explore?
Well, I should say first, it's unusual for a biographer to win this award. It usually goes to people who write fiction, or at least what they sometimes call creative nonfiction. I love biography. I love the sense of crafting a life from materials that are left behind, that you go back almost as an explorer, you dig into a life, and you try to find the patterns. And after a while, I realized, you know, going from cradle to grave was a bit of a slog. It just, a lot of that I could have done without. So I thought, why not take a really nice slice of a life and delve into that and tell it as though you were there, or at least you could take the reader there and let them see that life from the inside. One of the best compliments I ever received on that Twain book, by the way, was that a fellow said afterwards he felt so close to Twain that he could brush the cigar ashes from his sleeve. And I get that sense myself of trying to get really close to the person you're writing about. And it's fun when you've got giants like Churchill or Orwell who've changed the world in many ways, or even a great human being like Mark Twain.
Well, and I'm curious, you know, you say normally this award goes to writers of fiction or creative nonfiction, but that also strikes me as a particularly creative way to write biography. I mean, instead of, you know, casting it, you're looking for a particularly revealing window here so that we can see that not only can we look through it, but you're really inviting us to climb in through the window and be much closer.
We're looking for stories. And so, you know, a normal biography, I always used to joke, you know the ending, the guy dies. Right? And so that's the end of the story. So I set myself the task, especially with young Churchill, the mm-hmm. book I've written on Winston Churchill. It's called Young Titan, The Making of Winston Churchill. I set myself the task to end the book without my subject dying. And he fortunately for the whole world, doesn't die at the end of my story. But you can see what's going to, that the making of this man has taken place, and he's going to be ready when his moment in history comes.
How did you, I have not read Young Titan, so forgive the ignorance as I ask the questions, but how did you arrive at the end point? I mean, as you say, in normal biography, it is fairly easy to decide when you're done.
Well, this was so deliberate a decision on my part to craft a story that takes someone from, in Churchill's case, the moment he enters Parliament as a young man, to the moment where his career supposedly collapses and it's over and he's written off. And it takes him from age 22 or 3 to age 40. And I did it in such a way that when I was finished, I thought, you know, this should be made into a film or something. I really like this. But my publisher, my agent, no one was discussing it. I happened to go to London at the time, and I just wrote ahead to the producers of Downton Abbey. I have no shame. And I said, would you be interested in this? And I found myself sitting down with the producers of that series, and they bought the film rights to this book and were negotiating with the BBC now for a miniseries of Young Titan. And I thought that was possible because I wanted to craft a story that you could tell almost as you might tell a miniseries, and it wouldn't necessarily have to end with anyone's death of importance anyway.
We are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards and Indy Author Fair that are coming up in about a week and a half. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So, Laura, Michael raises the question here of how the awards are selected. He points out that he is the first biographer to win the National Author Award. What are the criteria for being considered for the Indiana Authors Award? And probably also ought to talk about what the categories are.
Sure. So the criteria, the main thing is the author has to either be born in Indiana or lived in Indiana for at least 5 years, just to make sure that we are honoring Indiana authors. We have three categories: national author category, for which Michael is the winner this year, a regional author, who's someone whose work is well known across Indiana, an emerging author, someone who's published no more than 2 books within the past 10 years, so writers who really are on the cusp of their career.
We could name also who the regional?
Sure. The regional author winner is Norbert Kraft, and our three emerging author finalists are Jessica Brockmole, Clifford Garstang, and Kelsey Timmerman, and the winner will be announced at the award dinner next Saturday.
And you've said already there are not many tickets left, right?
That's right, yes.
You're actually oversold?
The award dinner is sold out for the third straight year, so we're very happy about that.
Well, and again, in terms of this campaign, I mean, could you talk about the genesis of the Authors Awards and the author fair, and tell us how we got to this point?
The award really began with Eugene Glick, one of the great philanthropists of our city, and it was his idea to do something to promote Indiana authors and promote the literary landscape across Indiana. So he came up with this idea, and we worked with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation to kind of bring it to fruition. So our goal is to inspire authors who are just thinking about learning to write, and that's really what the Indy Author Fair is for. There's workshops on publishing children's book, publishing different genre fiction, on marketing your book, just a little bit for everyone.
Okay. Michael, I want to go back, obviously, to the books that you have done. So the fascination is to find this revealing period in a person's life. How do you choose your subjects, though? I mean, what I know, for example, I remember talking with the author Adam Hochschild, who's a friend of mine.
Yes.
And, you know, he said for him the toughest question is when he's thinking about the next book is it a subject, is it a person, is it an area that I can see wanting to spend every day of the next 3 years with and making that kind of commitment, or will I get bored along the way? It's a significant commitment to write a book like this. And you've got to have some pretty deep fascination with the people that you choose. How do you identify your subjects?
You look first for really big lives. You want something where there's an overabundance of material. The real problem for most writers when they start to do any project, it could be creative or whatever, is you run short. You write 100 pages, you think you've got a lot, but you're still 150 pages short of what you need. So I look for huge lives where I know there must be a part of that life neglected, where people just haven't looked very closely and where there's actually a great story. I try to get a sense that this story could exist almost apart from the rest of the life, that if it's a good story, I'll give you an example of Franklin Roosevelt when he gets polio as a young man. Mm-hmm. That's a terrific story. I don't think it's really been done properly, but this whole notion of Roosevelt, he's 40 years old. He's just run for vice president of the United States. He's lost. His career seems a bit of a stall. And then he gets
blew up his marriage, too.
Almost blew up his marriage. He gets a devastating disease. And he pulls himself back from that to the point where he's elected governor of New York and then president of the United States. I love stories like that. You can stop with his first inauguration. You don't have to know anything about what happens to FDR after that. You just need to know that this man has triumphed over a huge personal challenge. And those are great stories, but because it's often felt you need to do the whole life, a lot of those great stories get short attention in a larger book.
Yeah, that period actually that you refer to with Roosevelt is often sort of skipped over because a lot of it seems to be he's recovering, and the greater historical significance in terms of the country seems to be the political resurrection. But the human story is more fascinating during that period. So walk me through real quickly, you know, what drew you? I can see neglected pieces. Certainly, you know, there have not been many biographies, as many biographies perhaps of Orwell or Melville. But, you know, other than Abraham Lincoln, there's probably not an American who's had more biographies written than Mark Twain. And there's no shortage of books on Churchill. What drew you, let's say, first to Orwell? What drew you there?
I'd written a book about literary London in World War II, and the British market really liked it. So I was asked by the Orwell estate to write his authorized biography, authorized by the estate. Poor George couldn't have done anything at that point. He'd long since dead. Or Eric, as he would have preferred to be called. Eric Blair was his real name. And that was just a gift. That was a walk away. I mean, I could have spent the rest of my life writing about Orwell. He's so wonderful. And because of this NSA scandal and other things like that, I've been asked to talk a lot about his notions of the surveillance state and Big Brother. And you could make literally a career out of that writer. But I wanted to keep telling stories, and I wanted to tell them about lives that interested me. With Churchill, you know, it's interesting. A lot of British readers were just blown away by this book because they didn't know the story of the young Churchill. It had, when you're as famous as Winston Churchill is in the latter part of his life, he's 65 when he's prime minister. When you're that famous for what you do after 65, it's easy to forget what you did in your 20s and 30s. But they were huge things. I mean, he was the head of the British Navy in World War I. So he had the largest navy on the face of the earth under his command when he was 39 years old. So to bring that life back into prominence and give it some of the drama that it had at the time, that was a delight.
Yeah, it would have been a full career for most of us.
Exactly.
even if he had died in 1925, long before World War II came along. How about, you know, with Twain, I mean, I would think the challenge would be a little bit daunting because so much has been written about him, and obviously because he's written so much himself.
He wrote so many letters, and so many people wrote about meeting him. I mean, Helen Keller, who had only recently learned to write, wrote about him when she met him as a young woman. And when you get all of these various viewpoints together, you find an interesting thing. For the same instant in Mark Twain's life toward the end, because he's so famous toward the end of that life, you'll get four different viewpoints. Mm-hmm. Four different people will tell you the same story, and from each you can pick out really nice details. So it becomes a great way of telling the story when you have so much material because he's so famous.
We are talking about the Indy Author Fair and Indiana Authors Awards here on No Limits. My guests are Laura Wills, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, Michael Sheldon, who is this year's National Author Award winner. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Laura Wills, who's with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, and Michael Sheldon, who is the 2014 National Author Award winner in the Indiana Authors Award competition. We were talking just before the break about how you choose your subjects and find the fresh material. One of the things in the Twain book that I found fascinating was that you really did bring to life that Twain's fame in his own lifetime too. That you know, in terms of late 19th, early 20th century culture, he may have been the biggest celebrity in the world.
He was certainly the most famous person among writers in the world, but really, in America, he was probably one of the most famous people. He was known by so many people that he could walk in anywhere and get a warm greeting. Policemen used to stop traffic to let him cross the street. I mean, that's how famous he was. So he had incredible aura around him. And after the death of his beloved wife, he was very close to her. He says, you know, I've been to so many funerals, worn black so often, that probably the next big funeral is going to be my own. Mm-hmm. I'll go out wearing white. So the signature suit that people relate to him, this white suit, was really something he only wore in the last 4 years of his life. And he wore it as a very deliberate statement that he was going to make a grand exit from this life and not do it in a somber way, but do it in a really glorious way. And he did. He was as funny as he's ever been in his life. Bitter and angry about some things, but also just hilarious about other things. It was one of the great departures from life you'll ever find.
What was the biggest challenge in writing that book? I mean, you do a marvelous job of separating the man from sort of the image, something that he doesn't make easy because he cultivated that image pretty deftly and with a lot of energy.
He discovers Bermuda as a great getaway at a time when suddenly it was easy to get there 2 days by ship from New York. So he races down to Bermuda all the time, and he has these wonderful adventures. And to my surprise, no one that I knew of had ever gone to Bermuda and tried to find out what happened to Mark Twain. He made many friends there. As I discovered, he left a lot of papers and other important documents there. So it was hard. It was terrible to have to go to Bermuda to do this research. But I did
it's
it.
Lonely
yes.
Drug.
Oh, gosh.
Lonely
it was terrible.
Work.
Terrible. Difficult job. But, you know, that sort of thing, there are always these gaping holes in any story. And so I look for stories that have a lot of those gaping holes and then try to fill them.
Yeah, among other things, I wasn't aware, and I've since read also a couple of Woodrow Wilson biographies that deal with the same period, that the two of them kind of overlapped and were in the same social circle of a woman down there that Wilson may or may not have had an affair with.
No, he very much had an affair with. It's Mrs. Peck.
Yeah.
His mistress is on Bermuda, and he's the president of Princeton, and he sneaks off to go to Bermuda in the same way that Twain was sneaking away from New York to go there. But Twain was just going there to have fun. He loved the weather. He loved the people. But Wilson had an affair there on that island, And there's this wonderful moment where Woodrow Wilson, the future president of the United States, and Mark Twain are playing miniature golf together in Bermuda. And I just thought that, you know, that's a wonderful scene right there.
Yeah, it reminds me. I had an old editor when I was still in the newspaper business who used to say, why do people write fiction when there are moments like that you couldn't make up? What surprised you about Twain? And I'm going to ask that of all of the subjects that you have written about.
How funny and yet heartbreaking his story was. There's a moment where his daughter, who has epilepsy, and he's moved heaven and earth to try to help her. He's sought out the best doctors in the world. He's done everything possible. One morning, the maid in the house comes in and says, oh, Mr. Clemens, his real name, Samuel Clemens. She says, come quick. It's Miss Jean. That's his daughter, Jean. And she's died of an attack from her epilepsy, and she's only 27. And he says about that, he says, now I know how a soldier feels when he's been hit by a bullet. He has that sense that he's just been knocked over. And I think anyone who's gone through a terrible tragedy like that gets that sense that you've just been knocked flat. And yet he can get up. He's got that sense that this was a devastating tragedy, and he's as heartbroken about it as anyone. But the next day, part of his therapy, I suppose, was writing about it. And he puts pen to paper, and he writes a beautiful essay called The Death of Jean. And he's doing that while her body is awaiting the undertaker, because that's the way he is. He has to write. He has to tell his story. And when you can be a part of a story like that, it's just as exciting as anything I can think of.
We've gotten a question via Twitter, and if you would like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. This is from Gabriel, and Laura, I think it's to you. Are there any local artists, graphic novelists participating, such as from the Indie Web Comics Group or cover artists for books?
In the Indie Author Fair, I don't think we have any graphic artists this year. We do have, you know, talking about different genres, such as mystery writing, that kind of thing, but I don't think we have any graphic artists on tap for the Indie Author Fair this year.
But it would be something you would consider?
Oh, definitely, yes, yes.
Basically anything on the printed page you will consider?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Michael, going back, what surprised you about Churchill? I mean, that's a life, as you say, a lot of people have written about.
How brave he was, brave at almost every level. You know, at the end of this book, Young Titan, He has failed in some respects in government. At least many of the government's failures have been blamed on him. It's at the end of the first year of World War I. The war's not going well. Churchill takes the blame. And when he's thrown out of the government, most people would just, you know, slink off into a dark corner. He goes out, puts on a uniform, and goes to the trenches and fights as an ordinary major in World War I. And a reviewer of my book in India, of all places, said, this would be equivalent to Donald Rumsfeld taking the blame for the Iraqi war, and the next thing you heard of him, he would be directing traffic in Baghdad. And, of course, we know that's absurd, that the people who start the wars, who supervise the wars from afar, rarely fight them. But in Churchill's case, he felt almost a moral obligation, since he had been part of the beginning of World War I, to go and actually fight it and share the sufferings of ordinary people in the trenches. And I find that kind of bravery just amazing.
How much of that, though, is a change in sort of the, I'm trying to think of the term here, sort of the honor code of the era? Because, you know, you had Theodore Roosevelt all but engineering the Spanish-American War from being Assistant Secretary of Navy. And then, you know, as soon as it's clear the war is coming, he resigns from government service so that he can go fight. FDR wanted to do the same thing when he was in the Naval Department. That seemed to be part of, particularly that upper class mindset a century or so ago.
It is the old code, yes, but no one else in the British cabinet followed his lead. In other words, he was the only person who had any importance in the government who ever did anything remotely like that. So he's unusual, if not unique, in that situation. And it's, of course, today unheard of.
We've gotten a question also. Do you think that a politician like Churchill could make it in American politics today or British politics?
Yes, because he was so tough. I've been amazed to hear in recent years people talk about the uncivil way in which we carry on with politics. Those people should read a little history Politics is not going to church. It's a free-for-all. It's a fight. And nasty things are done and said. And the tough survive. And Winston Churchill was tough enough to get criticism and give it.
Also, on the last, Melville, I mean, what drew you to him? And that, what period of his life are you looking at there?
Oh, that was easy. There's the great mystery of how this man at age 31 writes Moby Dick, the greatest mm-hmm. American novel, and how after doing so, his career collapses. He, again, written off as a total failure, but it's the worst possible thing because he lives another 40 years. Mm-hmm. So imagine writing a masterpiece like Moby Dick, and for the next 40 years of your life, you're ignored, you're neglected. He goes to work in a customs office in New York, and the first day he shows up as an ordinary customs officer, his boss says, essentially, what are you doing here? Mm-hmm. You know, Herman Melville, he recognizes him and says, what are you doing here? Well, for 40 years, he lived in total, almost total obscurity after writing this great book, and I wanted to find out why.
And what happened to him?
Yes.
Are you going to deal? Obviously, there have been one of the things I think that has scared a lot of Melville scholars off been the allegations of domestic violence and all of that. How are you going to deal with that?
Two sides to every story, and there's a second side to that one, too. I think he married the wrong woman, and they did not get along, and it led to part of his tragedy. But, you know, it's as if someone wins the Indie Author National Award, and they're 31 or 32, and they've written a brilliant book. Say a young Vonnegut might have done that. And then because of personal tragedies and also professional ones, you never hear from them. And one day you're walking down the street in Indianapolis and you run into this fellow selling pencils or something on the street corner, mm-hmm. and his name is Kurt Vonnegut. You know, what if lives take that shift? It's fascinating to follow them because the whole time you're thinking, don't you realize who this man is? You know, mm-hmm. he wrote Moby Dick. We have an entire coffee chain named after one of the characters in Moby Dick, Starbuck. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think Melville, by the way, is getting any royalties
from that. Probably, no. Probably not. We are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards and the Indie Author Fair here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Michael had mentioned earlier in the program, Laura, that this is the first time a biographer has been chosen. Was that a difficult step for the panel this year?
I don't think so. I think our panel was really impressed with not only how well-researched and well-written Michael's books were, but how easy they were to read. I mean, when you're reading them, you don't even realize that you're learning about history because it's so enjoyable to read. So I don't think our panel had any issues at all with honoring a biographer.
And how many people were part of the competition this year? How many authors?
Well, this year we had about 180 nominations for about 100 authors. And nominations stand for 5 years. So those were, you know, those came in this year, and then nominees for the past 5 years were considered as well.
So how many authors overall were you considering this year?
Oh, I mean hundreds. I would say probably 300 or so authors.
Just all of them with Indiana connections?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what does that say to you about the state of Indiana literature? I'm going to let both of you speak to that.
I just think each year we are so impressed with the quality of work that we have here in Indiana and how many wonderful writers we have here in our state living in Indiana and writing about Indiana.
Michael.
Oh, I run into writers around Indiana all the time, and I'm always impressed by the quality of the work that's being done in this state. It's not known in the United States generally that Indiana is a great place to be a writer, but I think it is. I think we've got a lot of support for writers here. We're not that far from where everything happens in New York. You can get to all these places where the literary events are. It's a great place to be.
We are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards and Indie Author Fair here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. We've also got a question from a listener who says, did Churchill have an understanding of how greatly he impacted the direction of the world and the safety of the world by defeating Hitler? Did he have any idea of the magnitude of his leadership?
Yes, absolutely. He knew exactly what he was doing. He understood the importance of it long before anyone else realized it. When Hitler was a corporal in the German army in the trenches, across the way at one point during the World War I, Churchill was in the trenches about 2 miles away as a young major. But at that time, having already lost his great position of importance in the British government. But later on, Hitler was very much aware that this had been his, that this was his antagonist, that this was the man he was facing. And I think to some degree, Hitler was intimidated by Churchill. He found him intimidating. Many people did.
In what ways did Hitler find
him? Well, he was a fighter. I mean, yeah. he had faced fire as a young man in the Boer War. He had been taken prisoner and had escaped and gotten back to British territory. Churchill was known as an adventurer, as a man of great daring and dash. Adolf Hitler had no reputation of that kind. He was a flop in most things he did before he managed to persuade the German people to elect him to the chancellorship.
What was the source of that drive with Churchill? Because you're talking about, as you say, I mean, there some of the adventures in the Boer War, the famous escape and all of that, almost read like, you know, movie versions of Daring Do or whatever, and yet he was not a particularly athletic-looking man or anything like that. He could summon up vast reserves, though, as you noted, of physical courage, yeah, in addition to also having moral and spiritual courage as well.
He was a bulldog. He's often caricatured as a bulldog. He was a bulldog. He was a little bit less than 5'8". He was not particularly muscular, but I'll give you one example. In a cavalry charge that he was a part of in the Sudan, he returned to a field hospital to find one of his fellow officers' wrist dangling by its tendons, and the field surgeon said, "I'll have a skin graft and save this man's hand if anyone will volunteer." Churchill volunteered. They cut a slice out of his forearm without anesthetics of any kind and gave the man a skin graft, and Churchill never batted an eye.
Jeez. So in terms of, I'd like to get a little bit of how you got to the point of writing biographies. I mean, you did not start out doing that. I know you actually worked in a profession I used to work in, too, in newspaper world. You were the Baltimore Sun for a while. What brought you to writing biographies? Was it something you always wanted to do, or?
I liked writing literary biographies because there was a kind of school of literary biography where you take some great writer's life and write a good story of how they created their books. But the thing that really got me into this current form of biography was writing for the Daily Telegraph in London. There was a period in the 90s and early 2000s where, when I was a features writer for the Daily Telegraph, they had so much money and newspapers were riding so high, they could send me all over the world to do face-to-face interviews with just about anybody I wanted to. Sophia Loren one day, Serena Williams the next day. Sophia Loren in Toronto on a film set, Serena Williams in Rome at the Italian Open. That kind of life gave me that sense of what it's like to walk into a famous person's life for a day, get to know them, get a sense of what they're like. It was always a surprise. Nobody's ever who you think they'll be. And I got that sense of, what if you could walk into Mark Twain's life for a few days at a crucial period? What if you could walk into Winston Churchill's life for a few days at a crucial period? You'd be telling the stories about that for the rest of your life, you see? So I got that sense of what that was like by doing something like 200 interviews for the Telegraph, full-page feature interviews, and it was phenomenal.
Are there any, out of that period, are there any living figures that you've thought about trying this approach to biography?
It would be fun to follow somebody who's involved, like Barack Obama is, or any major politician involved in the heat of a battle, either a political battle or a financial battle. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's a Wall Street mogul or somebody who's involved in something that, you know, does alter the world in some way, and you can see it from the inside. It's always looking at things from the inside that interests me.
We are talking about the Indy Author Fair and Indiana Authors Awards. Here on No Limits, my guests are Laura Wills, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, and Michael Sheldon, who is the 2014 National Author Award winner. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the Indy Author Fair and Indiana Authors Awards on No Limits today. My guests are Laura Wills, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, and Michael Sheldon, who is the 2014 National Author Award winner. Also a biographer of note, we've been talking about his books on Mark Twain, Winston Churchill, soon to be coming one on Herman Melville, and of course, Orwell. Laura, I'd like to talk a little bit about, obviously, the dinner is sold out, but there are a lot of other events that go on in connection with the Authors Awards and the Author Fair. You talk about some things that people might be able to attend.
Sure. I mean, one of the events, we're actually doing something new this year called Indie Author Evenings. So actually the first one is tonight with last year's regional author winner, James H. Madison. He's going to be at Central Library at 6 p.m. talking about his new book, Hoosiers, A New History of Indiana. And then next week on...
Which is wonderful. It's one I just finished reading it. It's a wonderful book.
He's going to speak about his book, and book sales and signings will be available. And then next week on Monday and Wednesday, we've got David Hoppe and Douglas Wissing on Monday, and then a few of our former winners, Michael Martone, Barbara Shoup, Ray Boomhauer, and Greg Schwipps on Wednesday, doing readings and just communicating with the public. So we have those, and then the big Indie Author Fairs from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. on Saturday, October 25th at Central Library.
And is there a cost to attend that, or people can just show up?
It's a free public programs throughout the day.
And what are some of the highlights?
We've got a keynote speaker on publishing. We have Michael and our other 2014 Indiana Authors Award winners and finalists will be doing a panel discussion with some Q&A with the audience. And then in the afternoon, we have breakout sessions on poetry, children's books, blogging, all sorts of different topics.
Okay. Michael, what do you make of this part of the author's life? I mean, to some degree, it's not just the solitary exercise of writing. It's also that you have to go out and sell the books. And I remember, just as a personal, I try not to do personal stories, but I remember when I published my book 12 years ago, doing an absolutely god-awful book signing over in Terre Haute, where they put me outside the bookstore, and it seemed to me that I spent the next 3.5 weeks telling people where the restrooms were and where the cooking section was and all of that. It was just absolutely mortifying.
It is a tough business now because you can't just sit back. You do have to go on tour and you do have to promote your books. But, you know, if you've spent that time and you believe in your book, that's really what you should be doing. It is a kind of salesman's job as well as the literary side of it. But today, books need advocates, I think. And you ought to start at least being an advocate for your own book. But I think all books need advocates today. And I'll just put in another plug for James Madison's appearance on the History of Indiana. Nobody knows history the way that man does. And he if you have any curiosity about Indiana history, he can tell you.
We are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards and Indy Author Fair here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, what's it like? I mean, obviously, you have to get to know these subjects very well when you write your biographies. When you're finished with them, finished with the book, what is that like? Because I think if you've spent 3 years basically trying to climb into someone else's life and be part of so far it's been his existence, and you've got to let go of it, is there a period of mourning or some grieving that goes along with that?
You know, there is, but there's also enormous satisfaction that you nailed down a story, that you had this vision, and you were able to fulfill it. It is a sense that you've completed a journey. And I think, like any really good journey, perhaps more than just sadness at completing it, there's satisfaction. I've had probably more satisfaction than sadness at finishing these things. And I always jump straight into the next one because I'm thinking along the lines of who will I do next while I'm working on something. So I get that sense already of, oh, it's time to take another journey. So it's as though this year you decided to go to South America. Next year you go to Asia. The year after that, you go to Africa. Each time, you look forward to the journey and a little sadness when you finish it, but it's on to the next place.
Do you feel, is there a sense of distance after you move on? Like, can you summon up Orwell, Eric Blair? Can you summon that back up? Or once you've moved on to that next subject, does the relationship become a little more distant?
I've compared it to if someone asks you about your grandfather. If you were close to your grandfather, you don't need to study up on it. It's, you know them. So all these people, especially since they've been men and obviously older than I am, I regard them as grandfathers that I never really had, but that I came to know like a grandfather. So if someone asked me about Churchill or Orwell or Twain, it's almost as though they had asked me about a relative of my family. It's so ingrained in me now that I never have a problem bringing forward information. I still, in working on Churchill, managed to go back to the graveyard where Orwell is buried under his own name. It's a moving thing to see this tiny headstone with "Here lies Eric Arthur Blair" on it. It's in a lovely little village in England on the banks of the Thames. And nearby was the tomb of Prime Minister Asquith, Churchill's boss when he was a young man in the government. So I felt at home.
And do you get is it fun to make those kinds of connections and realize how the world works?
Oh, yes. In fact, once you start that, it never ends. In fact, it's interesting that both young Churchill and old Mark Twain met, that they ran into each other in New York at the Waldorf Astoria, and Churchill's job was to give a talk on the Boer War. He was 25 years old, and Twain was in his 70s, and Twain introduced him at this banquet at the Waldorf Astoria.
And Twain didn't think much of him. He didn't think of the imperialism much.
Half and half. He didn't like the connection with the British Empire, but he couldn't help but admire Churchill. Churchill was an amazing young man, so it was difficult not to admire him.
Do you have to like your subjects to spend this much time with them?
You have to respect them. I don't think you necessarily have to like them. Sometimes you run across things you don't approve of or you wouldn't approve of, but you always have to remember that the times were different, people had different assumptions. But I think respect is the thing you want to go into, and I think that's what we all want as individuals. You may not agree with what I say or do, but I hope I can command your respect, that sort of thing.
What part of each of these lives that you've done, I mean, each of these characters, I should say, the subjects, what were the things you didn't like about them that you sort of had to, okay, I'm going to suspend my moral judgment for a moment here to write this?
Every one of the people I've written about, every single one of them, have sacrificed personal happiness, and especially the happiness of the people around them, their wives, their daughters, their sons, their parents, for their ambition. And it is a delicate balancing act I think every human being discovers, is that if you have great ambitions, you're going to hurt people around you. Because the drive, the dedication, the necessary energy that has to go into building a great career is going to cause problems within any family. And people are always going to look at you and say, why weren't you doing this with the rest of us when you were, you know, spending all that time on politics or whatever? I'll never forget a woman who said to me about Orwell. She said, well, he would never come down and play bridge with us. He was always typing. I said to her, I'm talking to you today because he refused to come down and play bridge with you, and he typed the books that make him a world-famous figure.
Was there ever, you know, anything you discovered other than the common theme of ambition and the fact that they sort of sacrificed not just their personal happiness, perhaps personal well-being, but also that of the people who were close to them? Anything that you know, and you're looking at it, pretty much just appalled you?
Well, it's funny. I end up more defending these people when other people are appalled by them. I've had several people say to me something very funny. They'll say, wasn't Mark Twain just full of himself? And I say, he wrote Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. You'd be full of yourself if you'd written those books. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you expect? People who live very pleasant and somewhat ordinary lives can be very happy, but we're looking at people who sacrificed a lot to make a mark in the world, and they, in part of what they sacrificed, was that personal contentment that many of us think is the real purpose of life, is to find some contentment and satisfaction. But I'm also attracted to those people who are so restless, so driven, that push themselves until their last breath to accomplish what they want to accomplish.
You're working on Melville now, and you say when you're working on something, you're always thinking of the next one. Who are you looking at down the line, possibly?
I'd like to go back to another politician, as I may have revealed. I'm fascinated.
FDR.
I'm fascinated by FDR. I still think that personal struggle to overcome his polio is such a remarkable thing. Most people don't realize that Roosevelt's head is on the dime, mm-hmm. because he led the March of Dimes when it was dedicated to solving the problem of polio. And after his death, Congress passed the law to honor Roosevelt for that. So every time I look at a dime, I think about that.
And would you start then with the onset of polio, or would you start, what period are you thinking?
Yes, because it's so dramatic. He goes to a Boy Scout camp on one of these political tours, and the theory is that he picked it up there. It spreads by contact, and he falls ill within a couple of days of going to that camp, and it's just devastating. He doesn't know what's happening. It's called polio, of course, the real name, infantile paralysis. He's no infant. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how did this man in his 40s get this dread disease? And then how does he cope with it? Because there weren't really ideas or facilities set up to deal with somebody at that point in their life. And he pretty much pioneered his own therapy.
Is there any subject that you just flat couldn't ever think about writing about?
I need to write about a woman. I really would like to write about Virginia Woolf. She fascinates me a lot. I think she was one of the strongest women I've ever come across in literature. And I'd love to write about her. I'd love the challenge. I think it's difficult if you're a male novelist to create really valid female characters. But likewise, if you're a biographer, the challenge, I think, is to write about the other, to try to do justice to another sex, another life, another gender, another race, whatever. But to force yourself to think outside of a box that's comfortable for you.
Would you move outside of, so far you've written primarily about American and British figures, Western figures, would you move to another culture, or do you think the barriers there to understanding might be too great?
I really don't see barriers at all. I think lives are lives. You know, we have so many things in common that the common things about us are the things that interest me. We all face similar struggles. We all have similar temptations. It's really pretty much a human question, and that's almost universal.
How long does it take you to do one of these? I mean, how long is the research process and all of that?
I'm getting faster.
Yeah.
The Churchill was done in about 3 years. Twain was about five. Orwell was about five. So it's getting a little bit faster now. But it's still a difficult problem. It depends on how much you find, how quickly you find it, and what you're able to do with it. And if you're lucky enough to just walk into a great story, as I say, it's the case with Orwell, it's just a gift.
In terms of those cases, how much of it, you've talked about being at Eric Blair, Orwell's gravesite, and going to locations for the others. How much of the process of getting into that life involves having to go to the sites themselves, places, significant places in those people's lives?
Oh, very important. In Elmira, upstate New York, Twain used to take his summer vacations there. And a lot of people don't realize he didn't like to write in the winter. He would save his work until the summer. And almost all the great books that people love by Twain, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, were written in Elmira, New York, up on a beautiful hill overlooking the local river. It's just a gorgeous point. And when I walked up there and stood in the little, he had a little outdoor study where he worked. When I went up there and stood and looked out over that place, it was incredibly moving to realize the magic that had occurred in that one spot on beautiful summer days in upstate New York, which is green and gorgeous. And you just think, I get it. I see where this was coming from. Because he's got the whole world underneath him. It's a sense that the world is spread out below you. And I think authors love that sense that they're in command and steering a kind of craft along either a river or a sea, trying to reach a destination. He was an old riverboat pilot, and his study was shaped like the riverboat pilot cabins on the Mississippi River. So he could still think he was steering somewhere.
It was a moment like that. Was that when you felt like you got into Twain's world and his life? I mean, are there those so epiphany moments where you think, okay, I can step into this now? Or
it lights up. Yes, it does light up. I've had other moments with all the writers in that sense where it just kind of lights up. You get this sense that there you could turn a corner and there they'd be.
And are we going to hear stories like this at the author fair and at the Authors Awards?
Absolutely. It's almost hard to stop me.
And we're not eager to try here. So give me a story. You've obviously brought Twain to life here and brought Churchill to life. Melville is kind of an obscure figure. Everybody knows Moby Dick because of the large place it holds in our culture and to some degree Billy Budd. You know, what do we need to know about him to understand him as a man?
Here's a great story. He comes back from a trip to England, and he's 30 years old, and he's got this idea to write about a whaling expedition, and he settles in a small town in western Massachusetts in the Berkshires, and his neighbor, 3 miles away, is Nathaniel Hawthorne, mm-hmm. who's just finished writing The Scarlet Letter and is about to write The House of Seven Gables. And I love the idea that Nathaniel Hawthorne and Herman Melville are writing these masterpieces almost side by side, and they come to know each other, and they share a lot together. But the sad thing is, Melville's an overwhelming presence. He's very talkative, he's very domineering, he's full of his story, and poor Hawthorne is overwhelmed by Melville and essentially moves out as soon as he finishes The House of Seven Gables.
Flees to get away.
Yeah, he takes off because it's just been, it was an overwhelming experience to know Herman Melville.
And that is not something, because most of, you know, the public perception of him is that he was kind of this solitary figure.
He needed someone that he could talk to. He found it in Hawthorne and a few others. And when he spoke to them, it was very intense.
Okay, so if we are... want to hear stories like this, and not just from Michael, but from all sorts of Indiana authors, what do we need to know, Laura?
Come to Central Library on Saturday, October 25th, 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. You can also go to the Indiana Authors Award website, indianaauthorsaward.org, for more information on all of the activities.
Go ahead and give that URL one more time, because people do not listen to this program with pencils in hand waiting.
It's indianaauthorsaward.org.
Well, I think that will be the last word, but I'd like to thank you both. Laura, it's always a pleasure to visit with you. Michael, I've really enjoyed listening to your stories and talking with you. And again, I really admired your Mark Twain book. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
And I would like to thank all of our listeners for staying with us today and hearing these great stories. We will be back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about domestic violence. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.